Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you by Simply Safe, and our guest today is Brian McGrath, who is, and this seems very appropriate, a defense consultant and national security expert, and very lucky to have you this morning, Brian, with everything that's going on. Thanks for coming in.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Well, I want to talk about the absolute fiasco, and fiasco doesn't seem quite strong enough to describe what we're seeing playing out in Syria. I think that there seems to be an almost universal reaction, you know, outside of the Rand Paul world, that this has turned into a foreign policy disaster. And I want to break that down. But before we do this, I have to admit I am slightly obsessed with watching Twitter's rationalization going back and forth about this this weird video that was played at one of these Trumpy conferences, high profile Trumpy conferences that at his own resort. And I'm assuming by this point that everybody's either seen it or read about it. Probably more likely read about it. If you haven't seen it, it may actually be worse than you think. And this depicts the president. It's basically drawn off of the scene from the movie Kingsman, where there's a shooting in a church, and this portrays Donald Trump, the president of the United States, in the church of fake news, killing everybody, starting killing Bernie Sanders. And here's just a brief description. Let me see if get a brief description from the Washington Post, because there's so many. You know, Trump, you know, takes down Bloomberg, Vox, and fake news in quick succession before shooting Politico. One point, he grabs somebody who represents the Black Lives Matter movement in a chokehold and shoots the person in the head. After shooting MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, Vice News, Representative Adam Schiff, and Slate, Trump tries to shoot late Senator John McCain, but he's out of bullets. Instead, he uses his gun to deliver a vicious blow to the back of McCain's neck. Goes on to murder in various ways, stabbing actress and comedian Rosie O'Donnell. Repeatedly punches Representative Maxine Waters. He goes to shoot MSNBC's Mika Brzezinski and Senator Mitt Romney. Later assaults Hillary Clinton with a gun. The video comes to a dramatic end when Trump jams a sharp wooden stake through the head of a person whose face is a CNN logo. A now grinning Trump appears to survey the carnage as DJ Khaled's song "All I Do Is Win" plays in the background, and a pair of pixelated black sunglasses are lowered onto Trump's face. And of course, there's a tremendous blowback from folks in the media, as you might expect, about this. The White House is claiming that they condemn this in the strongest possible way. But you know, I guess you put this in some context here, and I wrote about this in our newsletter this morning. I mean, the video depicts a mass murder in a church by the president of the United States. It was put together by his own supporters, a lot of whom seem to have loved it enough to show it at this conference of some high-profile supporters at one of Trump's own properties. And it includes a logo for Trump's reelection campaign. So I don't know, Brian, whether you've seen some of the people saying, well, yes, but where was the outrage when this was in the Kingsman movie and this is just a parody? So on a scale of 1 to 10, how revolted and alarmed should we be about something like this?
I mean, I think we should be at 10 level revulsion and alarm. It's reprehensible. But we've been somewhat inured to this sort of thing after 3.5 years of this, and you know, it's bread and circuses in Trump world, and that's what they were given, and that's what they're appreciating.
And it will probably be just a blip, because it is sort of that sort of thing, you know. And I see, you know, Kurt Schlichter's on Twitter saying that, you know, his favorite Twitter are the what he calls the tortured explanations of why the same video is A-okay when it shows Christians being murdered in the movie, but the greatest atrocity in all of human history when it shows Trump fighting trademarks and meme pics. Which is a mind-numbingly stupid argument, because it's one thing to have violence in a movie, another to have it basically weaponized by a political campaign or movement to target specific individuals and specific enemies of, quote-unquote, enemies of the people. And I guess I'm old enough as a conservative to remember when conservatives thought that ideas mattered, words mattered, and that images like this were frightening. So I'm waiting for the next time that Donald Trump or any of his supporters blames violent video games for mass shootings. Okay, so Brian, let's talk about the ongoing disaster in the Middle East. And I don't know how else you describe this. You have, you know, hundreds of people connected to ISIS have reportedly escaped. Turkey using, you know, militias to murder people in the area. We announced that we were pulling all of our soldiers out. So just give me your overview of what's going on right now in Syria and what it means for American foreign policy and national security.
Well, there is the actual facts on the ground, and that is that a group of people who had been working with us very closely in what can only be considered one of the most effective military operations in recent memory, we abandoned them, and we abandoned them to essentially a Syrian, Russian, Turkey cabal that is now either going to exterminate them or make some sort of a deal with them that will almost assuredly be against our interests. Secondly, there is what appears to be the release of a number of ISIS prisoners, and that can never be a good thing. I think the most important thing that I take out of this from the strategic level, though, is that what was happening there in northern Syria was an excellent example of how a great power uses its influence, its military forces, its diplomatic abilities, and its economic power to manage things. It's an ugly, terrible world. And great power's job is to manage that ugliness. That's what was happening. You have folks like Rand Paul, and you have the foreign policy realists who take shots at people like me who consider ourselves to be primacists and American exceptionalists. And what we're seeing right now is a small example of what happens when the United States decides to sit it out, or even worse, to run away. And that's what we're seeing.
Well, let's talk about the winners and the losers here. You know, clearly the Russians appear to be winners, and also the Assad regime. Talk to me about this deal that was cut between the Kurds and the Assad regime. The Kurds essentially felt that they had no choice other than to cut a deal with the Russians and Assad. So how does that play out? And how does that play out in terms of the Turkish invasion? I mean, who's on which side now?
It is such a great question. It is a deal that we've seen throughout history. This is, you know, what the Thucydides told us. I think it was Thucydides. The strong do what they will, and the weak bear what they must. And the Kurds are weak, and they struck a deal that hopefully keeps them around as a nation in the future. I don't know the exact terms of the deal, but it sounds like it was better than destruction.
The role of the Russians is interesting here, and there's a long pattern here where you have Donald Trump seems to be willing to cut deals with authoritarians, whether it is Erdogan, Vladimir Putin, or Assad here. So how will Russian influence play out in the Middle East now? I mean, how has it been enhanced?
Well, the Russians have a long-standing interest in Syria. They were Papa Assad was a client state. Son Assad is a client state. They've had air bases and submarine bases in Syria for a long time to project power out into the Mediterranean and protect power back eastward towards the greater Middle East. That they are interested in Syria is not and should not be a surprise, and it's just part of the everyday business of great power dynamics that they are attempting to make that power manifest. What's interesting to me, though, is this growing sort of condominium with Turkey. Turkey is a bit of a wild card these days, and I think Turkey is playing Russia against the United States. You may remember Turkey recently decided to purchase a surface-to-air missile system that is Russian in origin. This is a NATO nation. So I think what we're watching play out is maybe a realignment of Turkey closer to Russia.
Yeah. Which has huge consequences. So let's talk about ISIS. This was one of the, this is one of President Trump's, you know, main campaign lines that he had, you know, bombed the crap out of ISIS, had destroyed ISIS. ISIS was defeated. A lot of people in the military and the foreign policy world said, no, this is just not true. The caliphate may have fallen, but ISIS has not been defeated. And now there's real concern that there might be a resurgence of ISIS, and particularly because hundreds of ISIS fighters and family members have apparently been released or fled or broken out of jail. I saw this the tweet over the weekend, which I'm sure you saw as well, from the New York Times correspondent. Is it Rukmini Kalamaki, who has been writing about ISIS forever, and probably understands this as well as anyone. And she tweeted, you know the game the kids play on the beach, the one where they spend all day building an elaborate sandcastle, only to then stomp it to the ground? That is our ISIS strategy. While the group was not defeated, we had made significant gains. Thousands were detained, not after today. That in just a few days, everything that we had done in that area has been wiped away.
Yeah, this is a prima facie case of the Donald Trump temperament as applied to foreign policy, something that I and others tried to warn the country about several years ago. The bottom line is that the campaign against ISIS was one of the more successful things that his foreign and national security policy was doing. And you had some small number of predominantly special forces soldiers interacting with a force, a land force, a ground force, which was the Kurds, which were doing our bidding, which was doing what we wished for them to do. And it was successful. And the president could rightly claim, I've never seen anyone fail to capitalize on success as successfully as he has. This is something he ought to be talking about, but he wasn't talking about it. He decides instead, in this sort of glandular, visceral way, I'm just going to walk away from it after talking to my buddy, the emerging dictator of Turkey. And this is what we get when you have someone who is unmoored, who doesn't understand these things, and who, quite frankly, doesn't have the people around him to help him understand it, or who could possibly make him understand.
Well, let's talk about the way this decision was made, leaving aside what the decision was. You know, you described it as this glandular or visceral way of making decisions. It appears to have been completely impulsive, completely reckless. And I think this is what has unnerved a lot of Republicans as much as anything, and people in the military, was he just made this decision. He was not listening to anyone. He didn't apparently consult with the generals. He didn't consult with the Department of Defense. And that alone has got to change the way in which all of those folks interact with him, but also the rest of the world. I mean, if you are a foreign country, whether you're an ally or an adversary, and you're watching this, the unpredictability must be really striking to them.
Yeah, I see it a little differently. And maybe this is a little Pollyannish, but I believe that there were people on his National Security Council staff making this case. And I believe they were making it right up to the time he decided to say, I'm just going to do it. So I don't think that his staff was sitting around not saying anything. What I do believe is that he just doesn't consider them. He'll listen as long as he doesn't feel like he has to make a decision, but when he feels like he wants to make a decision, he goes. That is the prerogative of the president. This is why I think our founders wanted us to elect men and now women of character, of moral fiber, to that office, because they recognized that it was invested with great power. And when you marry this great power with moral and ethical flexibility that we see right now, you get a recipe for true danger. And that's what I think we are right now.
There's also the question of reliability. There's one officer who has worked alongside the Kurds, told the New York Times over the weekend, they trusted us and we broke that trust. It's a stain on the American conscience. Now, that's a bad look. But does it have actual real-world tactical strategic implications that
we
have betrayed?
Okay, I think it does. I think the president has to some extent been quite fortunate in not having gigantic foreign policy problems during the course of his presidency. He said some persistent ones that he's been dealing with. But should something important come up, we can't do things by ourselves, big things. We can do some things. We can do some small and medium things. But when it comes to large undertakings, whether politically, diplomatically, or militarily, we want to have friends and allies. I think what has happened in the last 3.5 years is that the transactional nature of America's relationship with other nations has come to the fore. And it's, you can't just say that's America, they do that because they're good. That's America, they do that because it's our friend. It has come down to that's America, they may do this because we did this for them this other time. And that's dangerous.
You undoubtedly heard about Secretary Mattis going on Meet the Press yesterday, and was pressed like why he hasn't spoken out about this more aggressively, and he basically said this would be the worst time, I think, for generals to be doing this. That the Constitution is, you know, it's very, very strong, and that members of the military should not get out of their lane. What do you think about that? Given the moment we're in right now,
yeah. I'm a retired naval officer, and when I was on active duty, I recognized the rules, the practices, the norms, and the laws that prohibited me from certain political activities. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing that America doesn't wake up in the morning wondering if the 82nd Airborne is going to, roll over Washington. Break.
Yes.
There are a lot of very talented generals and admirals and retired generals and admirals with wisdom and foresight and experience on the international scene. And I want those people commenting in the policy arena. The sense that these guys should just go grab their plow and go back to the fields when they're done is lunacy. We lose important views. So when there, this whole thing came up about whether Mattis would come into government or not, my thing was, sure, I got no problem with Mattis coming into government. The problem I have was that when Mattis came into government, he took his general uniform off. He became a political figure, a figure who was an administration figure who confirmed by the Senate. And he then became a political figure. And he has ceased to be able to wrap himself in that, I can't comment because I'm the military. If that's the case, the House and Senate wouldn't have had to pass legislation that allowed him to be in the government. I think you have 7 years between the time you retire to when you can become Secretary of Defense, unless you get a waiver from our Congress. They gave him that waiver. And that waiver to me means you're no longer that military guy. You are a political guy. That is why I think this sort of coy stance that he's taking, make no mistake, General Secretary Jim Mattis's public persona is carefully curated. This isn't just some aw shucks guy. It's a carefully curated public persona, and it has worked for him for a long time. I think at this point, he has his sort of coy, I can't talk about this while I want to talk about this so I can sell some books. It's not working. It's leaving people cold, and they want people like him and McMaster and Kelly to speak out. They look to these people for judgment and equanimity and a sense of what's right, and these guys are on the sideline right now, and I think that's a bad thing.
Let's talk about the politics for a little bit. The Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was on television as well, suggesting that the president he seemed much more supportive of the president's decision than the Secretary of Defense, but also suggesting that they were ready to go with sanctions. What are the prospects of actual economic sanctions at this point, and would they make a difference again at this point?
Well, when you're good with a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and these guys they look at economic warfare, because that's really what it is, as their desired. You know, they want to use it against friends, they want to use it against allies, they want to use it against these dubious nations like Turkey. We can't really figure out what they are at this point. Turkey is a determined nation right now. They have national security objectives or perceived national security objectives that they are pursuing, that they believe are serviced by dramatically reducing the influence and power of the Kurds in the greater Middle East. That's just what's happening here. They're going to do it. They'll hunker down, sanctions the administration comes up with are effective in changing their minds, that remains to be seen. But it seems to be their go-to weapon, and it, quite frankly, is less successful than they think it is.
Well, also, you know, given what a disaster all of this is, at this point, quote-unquote, destroying the Turkish economy would also probably have the effect, wouldn't it, of hastening this realignment that you described earlier, pushing them out of NATO,
sure,
closer into the embrace of the Russians.
And the Chinese.
And the Chinese.
And my goodness, what would it do to the revenue at the Trump property in Istanbul?
There's a lot of rending of garments and wailing among Republicans in Congress about the betrayal. What they're going to do is certainly unclear, but Congress is going to be back in session this week. And a lot of the reports are that Republicans are going to give the White House an earful, which would be, you know, really angry tweets and maybe some forceful emails. But what do you make of people like Lindsey Graham? I mean, I wrote a piece about Lindsey Graham being, you know, the humiliation of Lindsey Graham, who had been fighting so hard for a, you know, strong line in the Middle East, and, you know, who had rationalized his bending the knee to Donald Trump because he was going to be in the room when bad decisions were made. And of course, he wasn't consulted. But since then, we've had him on that prank phone call, basically sucking up to the Turks. He's tweeting over the weekend that he talked to Donald Trump and is really glad that Donald Trump is taking steps to mitigate this disaster. I mean, where do guys like, you got a theory about what's going on inside Lindsey Graham's head?
Yeah, it's cold, naked political calculation.
But he looks ridiculous.
You cannot have your integrity taken by another human being. You can only give it away. And what we are seeing on a massive scale in much of the leadership of the Republican Party is a wholesale giving away of integrity. I thought your piece on Lindsey Graham was just a masterpiece, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I look at these guys. I look at the what, you know, they're speaking out, and they're speaking out very vocally, and I like the things they're saying. Because I've become such a cynic, I have to believe Mulvaney called the Senate Majority Leader and said, "Yeah, hey, it's okay. Tell your people they can talk about this, but they can't talk about that." So I think it's a way to depressurize the system, so that the folks in the Senate, specifically the Senate, don't feel like they can't recognize the chaos underway. This way, they get to say something without saying something that's personal to the president.
No, I actually think you're right about all of that. Now, whether or not as this goes on, they are genuinely rattled by this, I don't know. But I think there's a little bit of naivete in thinking that simply because you break with the president on Syria, that you're going to, quote unquote, break with the president more fundamentally, because I really don't think that that's happening. Okay, I want to move on to some of the things that are going on Capitol Hill and get your input, including the rather remarkable series of testimonies from ambassadors and national security officials that are playing out even as you and I are talking here. And I also want to talk about, you know, pull back a little bit to more of a, you know, 30,000 foot perspective on what all of this says about the abandonment of American exceptionalism by so much of the right. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter. and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. All right, we're back with defense analyst and consultant Brian McGrath. Rather remarkable testimony over the weekend on Friday from the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. And as we're talking on Monday, a former national security official, Fiona Hill, is testifying. And apparently in defiance of attempts by the State Department to block their testimony. And they appear to be rather, at least what we were hearing, rather direct and candid about what was going on with this administration and the rogue backdoor diplomacy of Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, I think it's, quite frankly, I'm happy about it. I want them to
These are gutsy women.
This stuff. I want them to get this stuff out there. And there's more testimony to come. I continue to watch my friends and former friends in the GOP and in the broader Trump defense world talk about no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo. And I think, guess what? There doesn't have to be a quid pro quo. There was a quid. I need you to do this. I need you to start an investigation. It'll be embarrassing to my main political opponent. That is requesting interference in an American election. That it doesn't have to go any further than that. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that the Democrats in the House haven't seen it that way and haven't moved quicker.
Yeah, but it's also interesting the willingness of folks to give this sort of testimony, to say this publicly, that you, and this is an element that we really haven't had until now with all of the controversies around the Trump administration, now to have some of these folks come forward and very directly challenge it. And you do wonder whether or not there ever is going to be this critical mass of whistleblowers or people from the career civil service officers, foreign service officers who are going to be more, outspoken. We were talking before about, General Mattis's reluctance to speak out, kind of a contrast to what we're seeing from some of these gutsy women.
Yeah, I think the concept of executive privilege has become so distorted as to apply to virtually any correspondence from any cabinet office to any lower official anywhere. And so that you get the administration making these claims and telling them they can't because of executive privilege or whatever. And I think these people are saying, well, no, that's not true. That's not what this is. I have a story to tell and I'm going to go tell it. And I'm glad they're doing it. I believe in the division of power among the branches of our government. It's one of the great things about our Constitution. I believe the executive branch needs to be able to do things in private, in secret, without the other branches knowing about it. I have no problem with that. But when those deliberations trigger whistleblowers or trigger honest Americans to say, wait a second, I believe laws are potentially being broken. The system has to be big enough to account for that too. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. It's the system sort of triumphing over one of the elements of it.
So you describe yourself as an American exceptionalist, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
What does that mean?
It means we are different. It means the circumstances of our founding are different. It means that American democracy and representative government at the time and to this day, I believe, is as close to this, the sort of inner strivings of the human heart as a political system can possibly be. I think we're different. I think we have been a force for good in the world. I think that occasionally gets distorted or mangled policy choices, but we generally tend to come down on the right side of things. I think the world is better with more America in it. I think the world is better when America leads. I think that we have a unique and enduring role, and I haven't seen a plebiscite held that leads me to believe that the people want us to be number two or to be number three or number four. They want us to be number one. I think it's job of people like me, and it's job of politicians to explain to them that that requires sacrifice. It requires cost. It requires being in places where they don't necessarily want to be, maybe, in order to keep the lid on things, because, you know, your pocketbook, your kitchen table finances are in fact tied to the global economy. There's no question about it. People like me, we stopped making, and we didn't make that argument. We hadn't gone out and gone across the country and explained to people why the global economy works and works for average Americans. We didn't do it. We just took it as a thing that was everyone understood, and the playing field was empty. And Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders jumped into that playing field in 16, and they had a lot of success with it.
This is one of the most extraordinary things, though, because I think American exceptionalism was as close to a foundational belief on the right throughout the Obama presidency. And I think that a lot of people who, you know, listened to Donald Trump saying, "Let's make America great again," thought that that was a continuation of that policy, when in fact Donald Trump, and tell me whether you disagree, really represents a rejection of American exceptionalism, that America is not necessarily any better. This transactional, "we'll defend you if you pay us," approach to foreign policy is very different from what we had understood prior to this. Not to mention his repeating his belief in the moral and ethical equivalence between our country and, say, Vladimir Putin's Russia is breathtaking. And yet so many conservatives have moved from this really strong belief in American exceptionalism to the, yeah, we're not really any better than anybody else, and that a make America great again becomes America first, this isolationist approach, this we don't necessarily need to lead. And it is kind of breathtaking. I wonder whether people have really thought this out or really fully understand the extent to which this guy does not believe in the American exceptionalism that you just described.
It's a funhouse mirror version of American exceptionalism. Is it distorted? It is this muscular, braggart kind of bully. Who doesn't want to risk anything? It is this pull up the drawbridge behind you. It is blame people who see this country as a shining city on the hill and who wish to come here and add to it as enemies, no matter who they are, by the way. You know, I have no problem with a physical barrier on the southern border, but it's always been, you know, let's get our Congress to pay for it, right? It is sovereignty. Who comes and who stays is the table stakes of sovereignty. So I've always been with them on that, but he has turned many of the things that made this country great into negatives, into things that he then distorts and amplifies in a way that bears no resemblance really to go back to watch those speeches Reagan made in the first term, and you think about the promise that was there. And let's face it, he was talking in 81 and 82 to a country that was on its ass, and he was painting this incredible vision. That's not what we get right now. That was exceptional then. This is not exceptional now.
No, it really is. It's so dramatically different. I'm just looking at there were a couple of pieces over the weekend that happened to be in the New York Times. Brett Stevens had a great piece about, you know, "Goodbye Freedom Man" and what we used to represent. That we used to be this beacon. Or Michelle Goldberg's piece, the beacon has gone out, what Trump and Giuliani have wrought. And then the subhead here: once upon a time, we spread ideals of democracy and the rule of law. Now we send Rudy. It's like, oof. I mean, just so like, oof, on two levels, including what's happened to Rudy Giuliani. The Rudy Giuliani has become a punchline when, in fact, he was once this icon, you know, icon. And she writes, you know, if America can be said to have a foreign policy at this debased stage of the Trump administration, it mostly consists of sucking up to strongmen while betraying everyone who ever believed in America's putative ideals. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. You know, I think that's fair.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, Rudy, I think Rudy wanted to be Secretary of State. I think he wanted to be Attorney General. I mean, I find myself thinking and watching him and seeing, again, the ethical and moral flexibility at best. That's the best way to characterize what he's doing. Thinking about, wow, he could have been a cabinet official. That just blows my mind.
Well, in effect, he has become a cabinet official, right? I mean, or because the cabinets don't really matter anymore. So I mean,
well, certainly in his portfolio, he's acting as one. And what amazes me is that a guy like Pompeo lets it happen. You know, Pompeo is a strong personality. I love the Pompeo in the election and the things that he said about Trump, but then suddenly he forgot about them, like many prominent Republicans. But I mean, he's a strong-willed guy, and yet he's got this loose cannon running around. Undercutting American diplomacy. I don't understand how you get to be in a position where you think that's okay.
Yeah, no, I agree. So let me read you Brett Stevens, the beginning of his column. The time is the early 1980s. The place is the South China Sea. A sailor aboard the USS Midway, an aircraft carrier, spots a leaky boat jammed with people fleeing tyranny in Indochina. As he helps bring the desperate refugees to safety, one of them calls out, "Hello, American sailor. Hello, freedom man." It's the sort of story Americans used to like hearing about themselves, so much so, in fact, that Ronald Reagan told it in his 1989 farewell address by way of underscoring how much went right for the United States when, as he put it, we stood again for freedom. And here's his kicker. Not anymore. When the world looks at the United States today, it sings a sorry song. Goodbye, America. Goodbye, freedom man. That's the global lesson from the regional catastrophe that is Donald Trump's retreat in Syria. The president made his case, as he usually does, in a series of tweets this week. Like their author, the tweets were, by turns, sophomoric and self-important, flippant and destructive. And I wonder whether this, though, is a turning point for some conservatives. Because, you know, up until now, I suppose if you squinted and you looked the other way, you didn't recognize Trump as the fundamental, full-throated rejection of everything that Ronald Reagan stood for. This betrayal of the Kurds and this foreign policy disaster and the resurgence of ISIS seems very off-brand for Donald Trump.
You know, I think the antithesis of Reagan aspect of Donald Trump was apparent all along. In 2016.
Well, I thought so.
Yeah, but I think the party changed, the electorate changed. There was a restive aspect,
But they didn't want this. This is not what they signed up for, or was it?
I think some of them didn't, but I think there's a third of them. I mean, he was right. The murder on Fifth Avenue thing. There's a third of them who just. They just think it's wonderful. They just love the chaos of it. I think the problem, one of the problems, is that Washington elites, people in the think tank community, the conservative grandees, they stopped talking about the things that. Joe Sixpack was worrying about. And this is, I remember the Romney campaign, the You Didn't Build It thing, the job creators thing. I remember cheering along and thinking it was the most wonderful thing.
Yeah, me too.
And then somebody after in the postmortem said, yeah, but lots of people were sitting at their table saying, I'm not worried about creating a job. I'm worried about keeping mine. And that simple way of looking at politics and American politics was really meaningful to me. And it's like, we needed to be more worried about those people who were actually having the job.
You know, this is interesting you say that, because I actually was the master of ceremonies at one of the endless rallies that people had, the, you know, you didn't build that. And they kept pounding away at it and going and going and going. And I do remember afterwards thinking, you know, you know, that what about the people who didn't want to identify with the with their bosses? I mean, basically, this was like the boss, the entrepreneur, which is fine, but it really was one-sided, and it was kind of one of those eye-opening moments. How did we not see this? How did we get so tone deaf? Now, I think, by the way, the Democrats are also incredibly tone deaf on a variety of issues.
Sure.
But that was an illustration of how that could happen to you in this bubble where we talk to one another and realize, like, yeah, the rest of Wisconsin's looking at us and going, yeah, you know, I actually do not own my own business. I didn't start my own business. When are you going to start talking about me?
I want to make sure I can afford healthcare and coach my kids' t-ball team. You know, that's that group of people, I think, felt left behind in 12.
Okay,
and they were talked to in 16.
Yeah, they sure were. Yeah. And we heard them all. Okay, so back to foreign policy. As you know, as we're watching this absolutely shambolic policy morphing into a disaster, and then the prospect of what would 5 more years of policy making like this look like and be, and what would this do to the country? It raises the question, are there any Democrats that would be a substantial improvement? Are there any Democrats that have that sense of American exceptionalism? Or do we just have to, like, move the Overton window of what is acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, my expertise and my ability to predict within the Republican Party was obviously shown to be faulty in 2016. So when I look at the Democratic field, a group of people whose policies I abhor and whose approaches to governing just bother me flat out, I have a hard time judging. But there are some that bother me less than others. And then the other thing is that we have this glorious system. Let's say the country is going to move left after Trump is gone, whether it's a year from now or 5 years from now. The country is going to move left. One of the very few things that he has done well in his first term is put a lot of relatively right-of-center judges in who are going to be the bulwark against this snap left that will come. So whether Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or Marianne Williamson or whoever wins the Democratic nomination, if that person ascends to the presidency, I have a feeling we will move left. It's a reaction that's coming, but I think it's not going to be as far as they would like in their policy statements for it to be. And then, you know, I look at Biden. I think Biden's probably he's probably won election late. But he's not a guy that scares me. He's a guy who I think understands the way the world works. I think he relates well with blue collar people. So if he were elected, I probably would not be as upset as others. And then I think Pete Buttigieg has a great mind. He's an exceptional young man, and I think he sometimes tries to hit for the fences with his wokeness. But other than that, I think he's a pretty bright guy.
Yeah, I think even though Joe Biden has been wrong on so many foreign policy issues, it's sort of wrong within an understandable range. It's the same analysis of, you know, as 2016 is, like, you know, Hillary Clinton is awful within an understandable range. Donald Trump, and I think in the last week, has expanded the range of how awful it could be. By the way, I'm just looking here at the Daily 202 email that just came out from our friend James Holman at the Washington Post. And the headline is, Trump hands Putin another win with Syria pullout. Vladimir Putin has won so much these past 3 years, he may get tired of winning.
Yeah, it's winning.
Yeah, winning. What an ironic legacy for the president. Brian McGrath, thank you so much for coming in and spending so much time with us today.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by SimpliSafe. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.